And it's a pleasure. We're starting a new series, as everybody knows, thank this, on the Langer affair, and we'll be hearing. And I think the series is going to go a little bit longer than I might have expected at the beginning, but Mark always has fascinating things to say. Dr. Shapiro is going to introduce us to many great Gedolim from the generation, you know, of this the establishment of the State of Israel and a little bit beyond. So without further ado, Vakasha Mark, Dr. Shapiro, yeah. Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just, you know, it's funny that you mentioned I'm teaching a Holocaust course this semester, so I'm going to mention this tomorrow, which you said, and I'll, you know, it's also the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, but Jews don't really pay that. We have our own day. But okay, so thank you, Jacob, for suggesting. I was supposed to do Rav Shimon Shkup, which I will do. I don't know how many weeks this is going to be, and I really took, as they say, a deep dive into the Langer dispute. And that's what we're going to do. And I think you'll find it very interesting because it is unique. There hasn't been certainly in the State of Israel, I don't even know, I'm trying to think when there's been a halachic dispute that reached the levels of viciousness and just craziness in terms of the newspapers and the things rabbis said about one another. So we are going to look, I mean, it is the most fascinating halachic event in the State of Israel's history. We're going to look at the history of it, the halacha, the sociology, ask the question, why was it such a controversy? I mean, there have been issues with Batei Din giving rulings all the time, and it doesn't create such a controversy. So what was it about this case? We're going to be introduced to all sorts of amazing figures. Let me just read you, though, before I even go any further, because today I'm going to have to set the stage a lot. Hopefully we'll start getting into the meat of the case, but there's really an important stage to be set to do it right. Here's a book. They translated Rabbi Eitam Henkin's writings into English, or many of them. Studies in Halacha and Rabbinic History, published Magid Press, 2021. And he has an essay. A valuable essay on this, in particular, dealing with his great-grandfather, because out of all the rabbis in the so-called Haredi world, Rav Henkin was unique, almost unique in that he supported Rav Gorin, to a certain extent. And we'll get into that later on. But what does, Henkin say? He says as follows on page 407. In 1972, there erupted in Israel a public controversy unprecedented in the annals of the 20th century rabbinate. And I think we have to go back to the dispute over Reform Judaism, which in its early halachic stage that we had classes about, to really see examples of the sharpness of what we're going to be speaking about. But and being that we don't assume that's really halachic, the reform. So let's, you know, I don't even want to put that in the category. I don't know of an example of when we really have an equal type of event. He says, known as the Langer affair, the controversy involved almost all of the great rabbinical figures of that generation to one degree or another. Almost all of the rabbinic figures. The public figure who caused the upheaval and stirred the center was Rav Shlomo Gorin, appointed chief rabbi of Israel in October 1972. And I'll show you pictures of him in a little bit. Hold on, I just want to change my, okay. Now this, I can tell you, this is a very difficult story to tell with all the controversy. And some people's attitude might be, we shouldn't tell it. But both sides felt comfortable spreading their approach. And, you know, if people come out with negative feelings one way or the other, I really can't help that. This is the history. It's in all the newspapers. It went on for years. So I think it's important. Now, I understand that people might say not to tell it. In fact, Rav Avram Shapiro, I have this new book here. I picked it up because I thought it would be relevant to the course, and it is. It's Rav Avraham Shapiro called Av Torah Av Chachma. It's on Maseches Avos, but it's full of stories. And Rav Avraham Shapiro, who was chief rabbi, in fact, I would go so far as to say he was the last chief rabbi of the state of Israel among the Ashkenazim who was a Gadol Yisrael. I don't know if you know that there's a new chief rabbi for the Ashkenazim, and I don't think most people even ever heard of him or even knew that there was. And that's going to be a big change, because part of this issue was that Rav Shlomo Gorin, he was such a great Torah scholar that you couldn't just ignore him. And we don't have, at least on the Ashkenazic side, great Torah scholars as chief rabbis. And the truth is that it was precisely because of the Langer case that's why the Haredi world thought it was important that the chief rabbis not be great gedolim, that they just be functionaries, basically. And that is the Haredi approach to the chief rabbinate. Now, Rav Avraham Shapiro was able to get in. He was based in Jerusalem, Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz Harav, but subsequent to that, there haven't been any gedolei Yisrael of the great Talmudic sense. Rav Lau was certainly a great figure, but not in the way we're speaking about. And that has a lot to do with the Langer case, as we'll see many other things as well. But Rav Avraham Shapiro, one of the things he says in this book is that Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon, the great Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon, according to religious Zionists, but he also wrote a lot about Gedol Yisrael. He wrote six volumes called Sarei Hameya, which is stories of great rabbis. And Rav Shapiro says, no relation to me, by the way, Rav Shapiro says that he has all the nice stories in these six volumes. If he wanted to have the not nice stories, he'd have another six volumes, the 12. So we are going to be doing one of the not so nice stories, but it is so significant. So we have to, as I said, it encompasses halacha, politics, and the dispute focused on a ruling of Rav Gorin, who was one of the Gedol Yisrael. And he was a unique individual. I gave classes on him at Torah Motion. You can listen to it. In fact, right now, my most popular scholar in residence class is a talk I give on Rav Gorin and the IDF. And it's very much in Yana Dioma, as we say, because of what's going on in Israel. And he was a unique individual with revolutionary ideas. There never would have been a Langer affair had it not been Rav Gorin. Had it not come, this ruling we're going to speak about, on top of so many other things he did that were controversial. But that's not enough. You needed other aspects to make it into the so-called Langer affair. But he took seriously the idea that halacha was to be decided differently in a Jewish state than in the Golos. I don't know of any Gedolim today who have this approach, that now that there's an independent Jewish state where Jews are living, deciding their own destiny, that you can't decide halacha the same way it was decided in Vilna or Warsaw 200 years ago or 100 years ago. And that's going to be an important aspect of the dispute. When you are chief rabbi of the state of Israel, do you decide halacha in a more Klal Yisrael sense, where you have to rely on certain approaches that maybe wouldn't have been accepted in a different era? So that's going to be important. As I said, we've had halachic disputes. We've had bitter halachic disputes. We've never had anything like we're going to see. And I think as we go through the weeks, one thing which at least I always think about, and maybe you will as well, is that if in all the attacks on Rav Gorin, people forgot about the real tragedy. At the end of the day, this is a case of mamzerus, two young people who are told they can't marry. And you will see the people trying to show that Rav Gorin is wrong and attacking him. And yet no one seems to remember that if Rav Gorin's wrong and you reject him, then two people's lives are ruined. That's never even mentioned. That just becomes, it's not even an afterthought. It becomes a way to destroy Rav Gorin, who to his credit, at least I'll say to his credit, was willing to sacrifice his career to a large extent, his place among the Gedolim for what he thought was correct and for two young people. And that is overlooked. Now, depending on your perspective, you will regard Rav Gorin, the way I just expressed it, as one of the greatest rabbinic heroes, a person who was willing to suffer the most incredible abuse, I think, in history, in the name of halacha, and to suffer this abuse in order to help his fellow Jews. Or you can see him as one who was willing to use halachic loopholes to bring himself into power as part of a dirty deal with the labor government to become chief rabbi. So clearly opposing views on how you view Rav Gori. Now, I want to read you during the dispute, one of the Dayanim who supported Rav Gori. The dispute, as we'll see, was so bitter that Rav Gorin's supporters could not make their identity public. When I say bitter, I mean bitter in the sense of matter of life and death, like letter bombs and things of this nature being sent to Rav Gorin's house and physical attacks. It was such that for actual physical safety, rabbis had to keep their identity secret. And but I will be able to identify who all these rabbis are, with maybe one exception. And I have to thank a man named Yair Halevi. I had finished I was all ready for this course, this semester, this section.
Get out of here.
Gotta shut off. I was all ready for this. And 2 weeks ago, I get a hold, thank you to Yair, of his doctoral dissertation. And his doctoral dissertation is about the Haredi Revolution. He actually argues that the Langer affair was essential to create the new Haredi society. So in the last 2 weeks, I quickly went through it and I just added a lot more material, interesting stuff. So thank you very much, Yair. And, but he quotes on page 166, one of the Dayanim who says as follows, speaking to Rav Betzalel Jolty. We'll be introduced to who this Rav Betzalel Jolty is a little later, but he is the big antagonist, or one of the big antagonists, to Rav Gorin. And the Dayan says to Rav Jolty, if you want to continue your battle against Rav Gorin, that's perhaps your zechut. You have the option to do that. But how are the ach and the achot? That's what it was called, the ach and the achot, the brother and sister, the Langer kids. How are they guilty? Everything you're doing, you know, you're hurting them. He says, are they your ammunition to fight against Rav Gorin? Now, I'm going to tell the as much as I can from an outsider's perspective. And now, obviously, we're going to get into halachic disputes. I'll share with you both sides. I'll also tell you that I think it's clear that if this wasn't Rav Gorin, if it was another rabbi, it wouldn't have played out the way it did. And nevertheless, I'm not able, obviously, to tell a Talmid Chacham, and we're going to be dealing with not just Talmid Chachamim, but Talmid Chachamim of the highest level, Gedol Yisrael, the highest level. I can't tell them that they misunderstand the Gemara or misunderstand a Tosfot. Obviously, I can't do that. But what I can tell a Talmud Chacham is his history is wrong. And I don't care if we're dealing with the Gedol Yisrael. They're Gedol Yisrael because of their learning. They're not Gedol Yisrael because of their knowledge of history. So when we have a Gedol Yisrael who makes a statement that this can never happen or this has never happened, and I can show you that it indeed has happened. And we have that's something I'm able to challenge them. Furthermore, there's another point that I think is important, that the Talmid Chachamim didn't make a mistake, but many of the masses made this mistake, and many of the polemicists, because unfortunately, in the opposition to Rav Gorin, the newspaper Hamodia and other newspapers opened their columns to Balabatim, to what they call Askanim, political types, to attack Rav Gorin. They did not leave this as a dispute between Gedolim on each side. And we will see why the floodgates were open and why it was thought permissible for every Tom, Dick, and Harry to attack Rav Gorin. So I think that's very unfortunate. But often these people say things like Rav Gorin's major approach is going to be that in dealing with a matter that affects the entire state, we can look for leniencies and we have to have a certain approach. This was his approach basically to dealing with halacha in the state of Israel, that you have to consider the entire population, not all of whom are committed to halacha, that it's different as a private decision versus a national decision. And this is something that the Haredi world, for the most part, couldn't accept. And you'll often see in the polemics, people make comments such as that there's no such thing, that halacha is halacha. And you can't say that it who you're deciding for, that halacha is going to depend on this. Now, I've heard it myself in America about different issues where people will, you know, say this is like conservative, that you know, the halacha is going to be different, the decision based upon who asks you and things like that. And I have to say, and even if I thought it would be stronger to say this, I have to say it's completely wrong. It's wrong historically. It's also wrong halachically. Anyone who's learned, you know, Yoredei, you know about Hefsed Merubah, you know about all sorts of other things. Let me just read you something from the book I mentioned, from Avraham Shapiro, page 593. And this story, I think, is, I just saw this story today, actually. I think it's a great story because this really sets the mindset of Rav Gorin. Page 434. The other thing I saw, I'll share with you as well. Here's a story that Rav Avraham Shapiro told of from Ratzi Pesach Frank, Rav of Jerusalem. A bunch of people were at Ratzi Pesach Frank's house, and a shayla came in. It says a kid came with a chicken. Is that where it is? Yes. To show a Yalda, a girl, about a chicken. And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank started asking, like, where do you live? And when she told him where she lived, Rav Frank said, chicken's kosher. And when the girl left, the students who were there said, Rebbe, why were you interested in where the child lived? What does that have to do with Pesach that you decided it's kosher? And Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank replied, that really there, I had a doubt about this chicken, and the halacha could have gone either way. But when I heard that the girl came from far away to ask a question about a chicken, I understood that they're a very poor family because they have rabbanim in their neighborhood. They could have asked. But the fact that she sent her child all the way to me, because obviously she wanted to make sure that, if, you know, she was worried that the local rabbis might not feel comfortable giving a ruling of leniency. And it must be that this is a very poor family. That's why they'd go the extra mile. It's not like they could just throw the chicken out. And therefore, that forced me to rule that lenient. And the editor here says that Rav Avraham Shapiro use this story, then when we decide halacha, we decide it by the person, the questioner, and the place. The al haposek, and the posek has to see the hashlachot, the results of his psak in a larger, you know, in the long view. It's not just the chicken. It's the fact that the family's poor, and Rav Gorin's point is going to be that we have to take the long view. The other point I wanted to mention, I saw in this book on page 593, just a different case was that they tell us, see, one of the issues is going to be that the Beis Din is going to rule that the kids are mamzerim, and then Rav Gorin's going to open it up. And we're going to see that Rav Nissen, the chief rabbi, thought that it was okay to reopen this case, and others thought differently. It's an interesting question. You know, can you just reopen a case that you give it to a different rabbi to try to find a heter? And Rav Avraham Shapiro, another story is that Rav Avraham Shapiro, a case came to him, and he saw that he could not paskin it lakula. And, a rabbi saw it. He couldn't paskin lakula. He went to Rav Avraham Shapiro, and Rav Avraham Shapiro said, that he too could not paskin lenient. However, he said, you can tell this woman that she can go to a certain rabbi. if we can't be lenient, Lamashata, you know, if we can't be lenient, Tagid La Shtecha Ravahu. She doesn't need, he lo tzricha lisbol biglal shanachnu machmirim. That is, Rav Shapiro said that you and I, we don't feel like we can paskin this and come out with a lenient decision. But why does this woman need to suffer because of us? We know that that Rav is lenient on these matters, so send her to that rabbi. And I've said it many times before, the Rishon Zalman Auerbach, when questions of abortion came to him, he didn't want to paskin because he felt he had to be strict. But he knew that Rav Eliezer of Oldenburg, if it's Eliezer, was lenient. So he said, you can rely on him. So the question is, why in this case, we're going to see, did the rabbis feel, who opposed Rav Gorin, that even though they didn't see the way to decide leniently, why wasn't Rav Gorin great enough that we can rely on him? So that's a story we will deal with. Furthermore, I did a whole series of classes on Rav Shapiro. I wish I had this book when I did it, but let me share another story with you, which is also directly relevant to the Langer case. And this comes from page 595. It actually comes from Rav Cook. I found it in the letters. But actually, let me read Rav Cook's letter. Rav Cook's going to have a part in this story as well, as we'll see. But if you look in the letters of Rav Cook, number 483, Rav Cook tells the following story. In the days of Rav Label Shapiro, the Rav of Kovno, the leaders of Kovno, Nichbedei Kovno, wanted Rav Yisrael Salanter to live in Kovno. And when they asked Rav Label Shapiro, he said to them, if he wants to accept a position as a dayan, as a rov in Kovno, that's very good. But if he just wants to live here as a private citizen, I don't want him here. That's what Rav Label Shapiro said. Why? I mean, who would not want Rav Yisrael Salanter to live near them? So what did Rav Label say? When they asked him why, he said to them, Sha'afilu ha-ga'on ha-yoter gadov ha-tzadik ha-yoter niskav, even the greatest gadol and the greatest tzadik, lo yuchal la'amod al da'ato sha'ha-meshubad ha-rot l'rabi, does not understand what it means to be a rav who has responsibility for the people. U'adat sarat nafsho, and to know his difficulties. K'dei la'dunot kok l'kafsot, to be able to judge him l'kafsot favorably. A rav who has the responsibility of an entire community, he has the responsibility on his shoulders, he has to take into account all different considerations. If you have an independent Talmud Chacham living in the city who doesn't have these responsibilities, say a Rosh Yeshiva or something like that, they're not going to appreciate and understand leniencies that you offer and kulas, and they're going to be criticizing you. But they don't know what they're not in your shoes. And Rav Leibola, I mean, it's hard to imagine a Yisrael Salanter, who himself was known as a big, lenient amekel. He's the one, you know, the whole story we tell about Yom Kippur, and the Dayanim didn't want to permit eating on Yom Kippur during the cholera epidemic. So I think Rav Label Shapiro was probably worried for no reason, but we understand what he was saying. And in fact, Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, the later Rav of Kovno. Hold on, let me pull the picture of him. I can tell you that Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapiro, hold on a second, let me get a... Oh, sorry, I got it here. I got to share with you. Here, Avraham Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro. There he is. He suffered on this very reason. Today, people don't speak about this because he's one of the great Rabbonim, and Rabbi Oshri made him famous, responsible from the Holocaust. But the yeshiva world degraded him. And he would give decisions, and they would attack him for it. And his answer was always that you know, I'm not deciding for yeshiva people. I'm deciding for an entire community. And like he would have events with boys and girls to try to make shiduchim. He supported the Yavne school system. So that's an important point. And Rav Gorin, as we'll see, one of his responses is going to be that these rabbis in B'nai Brak attacking me, they're not rabbanim. They're not dayanim. It's very easy when you're sitting in a yeshiva in a theoretical way to look at the case and criticize me. Try taking on yourself the responsibility of a community. And Rav Aaron Spear basically says the same thing. He doesn't add anything more to that. But of course, you know, you have a case like this, a story like this, and all of a sudden you ask yourself, well, wait a second, what about the Chazon Ish? Doesn't this mean that someone like the Chazon Ish, who was never a Rav, shouldn't be poskening on matters? And we know he did. And the truth is that that was, Rav Avadya Yosef actually says that if the Chazon Ish was an actual Rav of a community, he wouldn't have been so strict. When Rav Avadya said that, the Ashkenazim went crazy over that. So I don't really have an answer to that, but that's many Rabboni who actually work in the Rabbonos have said that people who don't have responsibility of a community should not be criticizing. It's very easy. So that's going to be an issue as well. You know, Rav Avadya says that's why he prefers Ratzi Pesach Frank over the Chazon Ish, because Ratzi Pesach Frank was the Rav of a Kehillah. Now, let's get back to our case. We're going to be dealing with the case of marriage and mamzeros. It's really the most significant type of cases you can have. And yet, Jewish history is full of cases where gedolim have permitted mamzerim, have permitted women to remarry, even though others disagreed. And it didn't create a huge controversy. It was understood. I have a different opinion, but he's a gadol, so we can rely on him. In fact, there was a case about 15 years ago, which on its face is much more extreme than anything Rav Gorin is going to argue, where a marriage was voided. I don't need to get into the details because it's these are people who live in our community, but it's all over the internet. You can find it. It was in Philadelphia. And Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky was very much involved. Basically, they just voided a marriage. The husband doesn't want to give the get, so they say the husband's is mentally defective. She never would have married him. Now, the guy works for a congressman. I mean, it's like it's a very hard case to make, and Rav Sternbach attacked it and others. But at the end of the day, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky is enough of a gadol that even if you find it a strange thing, basically doing what the Rachman Beis Din did, you know, Rabbi Rachman, you can attack because he's Rabbi Rachman, but you don't attack Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky or Rav Nota Greenblatt. And we have other cases. Rav Moshe Feinstein had unbelievable rulings freeing women. So it's something about Rav Gorin that's going, so we cannot forget the personalities. Now, in his, and we'll learn about them. In his dissertation, right at the beginning, Yair Halevi sees the Langer case as central to the creation of a Haredi identity. When we look around today and we see a Haredi society, this did not exist in the 60s. And it begins to exist, Yair Halevi argues, in the 1970s with the Langer case. And we're going to see differences between, do you have a Klal Yisrael sensibility when it comes to State of Israel and Jewish law? Or do you focus on your own community? And that's how halacha should be. In discussing why this case became so vicious and bitter, Halevi says it's not enough just to look at the personalities, especially Rav Gorin and the enemies he had made with his rhetoric and his halachic decisions. The fact is that this case became a public cause. It was covered by all the secular newspapers. Had the Langer affair, and we're going to go through the whole story of it, hopefully today we'll start, had it never been in the public square, had it just been among Dayanim, you wouldn't have had a controversy. But this became an issue where Moshe Dayan was advocating for it, and Golda Meir, and it was in the newspapers. So therefore, it became in the Haredi mind an example of secular society versus halacha. of course, we support halacha. And then Rav Gorin then wants to show that really we can permit this. Then Rav Gorin is siding, in their opinion, with the secular society. So that's why it became so important. In fact, Halevi quotes the Aguda deputy Shlomo Arintz as saying that Rav Shach is catapulted to prominence because of the Langer affair. Had it not been for the Langer affair, Rav Shach would not have assumed the place of prominence he did. Maybe he would have assumed it years later. Maybe he never would have. Remember, he was quite old as it was, quite then. In his 70, I guess, around then. In fact, what I need to...
Dr. Mark, if I can interrupt for half a second, a few people have sort of, you know, texted. Not everybody is familiar with the Langer case. So if you can, before you go on, just spend 5 minutes going over the rough outlines, and then you can spend a number of weeks going through all the details.
Will do. Okay. Actually, Rav Shach was born in 1898, so he's already 74 at this time. So it's very unusual for a person to become a gadol like this in the 70s. The Langer case is about two, and we're going to go through the whole story, two children who were declared mamzerim, that is, that their mother had an adulterous relationship. And that means they could not marry religiously in the state of Israel. And this became a huge cause celeb that the state of Israel politicians were speaking about and instituting secular marriage. And Rav Gorin was able to find a way to permit the children to marry. How he was able to, we'll get into. So you might be wondering, this is the greatest halachic dispute ever to hit the state of Israel. As Henkin said, the greatest halachic dispute ever in the 20th century. Maybe the most vicious halachic dispute in all of Jewish history. This is because the one Beis Din ruled that two children couldn't get married and another Beis Din ruled they could. Why should that even be an issue? That's what makes the story so tragic and so fascinating. And that's the case. It's a case of Mamzerus. I'm just really trying to set the stage here. By the way, Rabbi Elyoshev, who was the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage of the generation from the Haredi world, he never would have been that if it had not been for the Langer case. As we shall see, he leaves the chief rabbinate. He's a dayan on the chief rabbinate. In the 1960s and early 70s, the Haredi world, the B'nai Brak world, I should say, said you can't be a dayan because then you're working for the government. And that's Zionistic. Rav Elyoshev was an employee of the Israeli government, part of the chief rabbinate. Such a man could never be the Gadol Hador of the Haredi. However, because of Rav Gorin, and especially the Langer issue, we're going to go into details on all of this. Rav Elyoshev leaves the chief rabbinate. And this is the best example of how in the Haredi world, ideology really trumps everything. Because Rav Elyoshev was the same Talmud Chacham he always was. But once he is no longer in the chief rabbinate, and once he showed this bravery, disputing with Rav Gorin, then now in B'nai Brak he can be accepted. And even though familial ties, he always was, his son-in-laws were Chaim Kanievsky, but there was always questions about him. The Brisker Rav said it's forbidden to step foot into Heichal Shlomo, and he was part of this institution. Once he no longer was part of it, then he could become a Haredi Gadol, and he does. We all know the story. He becomes the Haredi Gadol, and he is something that Rav Shach and the Stipler are not. He's a posek, and he's a dayan. So there's all sorts of, it goes even further. The whole issue of the chief rabbin of the state of Israel and the system of dayanim, which was taken over by the Haredim. So the modern Orthodox, so this was their institution, and they founded it, now feel left out. This is all because of the Langer dispute. Because when Rav Elyoshev becomes the Gadol Hador, unlike Rav Shach and the Stipler, Rav Elyoshev says, we have to take over the chief rabbinate and take over the system of Batei Din. So he starts telling, so Yateid Ne'eman turned on a dime. As soon as Rav Elyoshev is the Das Torah, now Yateid Ne'eman speaks about how we have to become Dayanim. And the whole problem with Geirus, conversion. and the voiding of conversions and all that. That's because of the changes in the chief rabbinate, which are all due to the Langer case and Rav Gorin. So the implications are vast. You should know that it didn't have to be this way. I want to show you, hold on. I want to show you some pictures here just to show you, first, here. Here's an article that I was looking for a picture, and lo and behold, it's an article from just last year, or not a few months ago. Psak Din Ha'achla Acholt. That's the Langer case. So it says history of the day. But here's a picture. Who's in it? Rav Gorin, Rav Elyashiv, and Rav Unterman. In good days, before things get really bad. What do we have here? Here we have, that's Rav Gorin, that's Rav Aaron Cutler, that's Rav Shabtai Yogel, he was a Rosh Hashiva of Son. This is the Aguda Convention, late 50s, I think, or early 60s, or it must have been late 50s. So here we see Rav Gorin and Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler was very fond of Rav Gorin. Rav Aaron Cutler knew Rav Gorin very well because Rav Gorin was the Talmud Muvhak, the leading student of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. I shouldn't say leading student because he went to Chevron really, but close Talmud, not in an official sense, of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer writes an approbation to Rav Gorin's first sefer. So much so that here's a letter, copy of a letter, where Rav Aaron Cutler is trying to get a shidduch for his daughter. And he writes to Rav Aaron Cutler, writes to Rav Issa Meltzer, his father-in-law, Heich, I guess that should be like Heyach. Hu ha-matzav odot Rav Shlomo Goronchik. What's the situation with Rabbi Gorin, Rav Goronchik? Im hu panoy adayin, if he is still single, madua lo yikanes kol b'cheshbon. Why aren't we thinking about, when we think about a shidduch for my daughter, why aren't we thinking about Rav Gorin? Well, it turns out Rav Gorin was already, he was involved or was soon to be involved with the Nazir's daughter, and that becomes his wife. Actually, in Rav Gorin's autobiography, he tells the story. He wasn't involved yet with the Nazir's daughter, because in his autobiography, he tells the story. He doesn't mention Rav Gorin, but he says one of the Gedolim was interested in him. And whatever, he says that it wasn't for him, so it is. She ends up marrying Rav Dov Schwartzman. And so it's interesting, had Rav Gorin become the son-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, maybe he would have been protected in a certain way. It's hard to know. Here's another. Let me show you another picture. Hold on a second. Here's a picture from one of the biography of Rav Gorin, the English biography. You see Rav Gorin on the right, in the middle, Rav Bezalel Jolty. They were good friends one time. They were students together, Iluyim, together in the Chevron Yeshiva. And on the left is Rav Futner. How times will change, unfortunately. Now, even before Rav Gorin, for those who don't know the history, he's appointed chief chaplain of the IDF. He's appointed chief chaplain by Ben Gurion of the IDF because he's not like the other rabbis. He was already in the Haganah when he was a yeshiva student in Chevron. He joins the Haganah. And from his youth, he believed that it's vital for Torah scholars to be in the army. He didn't accept this approach that we see today, that yeshiva students shouldn't be in the army. In fact, Rav Gorin is the one really responsible for making for that religious soldiers can be in the Israeli army. I mean, he went to Ben-Gurion. And, the assumption was that you're going to have religious units and non-religious units. In fact, before there was a state, there was something called the Haganah, and you had the Palmach. which was the strike force of the Haganah, and you had separate religious units. Everyone assumed that you're going to have separate and irreligious, because how can a religious Jew be in a unit with an irreligious? They don't know care about kashrus or Shabbos or anything like that. And this was the position, by the way, not just of the Aguda, of the Mizrahi. And there already were religious units of the Palmach. And the assumption was, when the IDF is formed, you'd have religious units. Rav Gorin thought that that's a mistake, that we have to be together, fight as one people. And he was able to convince Ben-Gurion about this. And Ben-Gurion the decree came down that there will not be any separate units. And since then, until today, now you have the Nachal Haredi, but the idea that you'd have separate units for the irreligious and the religious, it was that all Jews are together. We have different views, but we're together. So when the State of Israel was formed, Rav Gorin, who was known, he was in the Haganah, he was chosen chief chaplain. He remains that till the late 60s. Early 70s. He becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, or late 60s. I forget now. And then he becomes chief rabbi of the State of Israel. So we'll get some of the story history we'll get as well. But you should know that already when he's in the chief rabbinate of the IDF, he's coming up with interesting, unusual ideas. With Rav Gorin, everything in Torah he touches, you see originality. And that's a problem, because it's, we have originality and sometimes it's, but every single time he comes up with original, and sometimes he comes up with ideas that no one ever spoke about before. In fact, there's someone who listens to these classes. He's a doctor, but he's a Kohen. So Rav Gorin came up with a way for a Kohen to be a doctor. He has a whole approach, go to medical school, I should say. Rav Gorin's originality was unique. And he would use the Jerusalem Talmud to come up with new ideas. He says that now we've returned to the land of Israel, so we have to use the Yerushalmi. And so as long as he's in the army, though, this didn't bother what we call the Haredim today. They didn't bother him so much, because he's in the army. He's doing important work. Once he becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and then chief rabbi of Israel, then that's going to be a danger to the halachic system. In fact, right before he was elected chief rabbi, they come out with a book of his, and here's the title of it: "Hamaracha al Hatzalat Harabanut Harashit." That is v'hasakana, and the danger of the appointment of Rav Gorin. So this is Tishrei, so the fall of 1972. So this is a book, and it's full, a small book. But it's full of all what they say are the improper things that Rav Gorin advocates for. Rav Gorin gave talks in which he spoke about how Jewish law is it's not frozen, that we can find halachic solutions. Now, if Moshe Feinstein said it, no one will bat an eye. But Rav Gorin was known that he really meant that we can have new approaches in the State of Israel. So it's a whole book with various statements that Rav Gorin stated that they thought were problematic. His views on conversion. We're going to see his views. In fact, at the end, we're going to talk about the case called the Seidman case, in which Rav Gorin's approach on conversion is going to be at odds with the approach in the so-called, I say, Haredi world, because today we call it that. It wasn't called it then. So there was a great danger. And how did Rav Gorin become chief rabbi? I'll get to that as well next class. I just want to mention, however, that there's a in this book, for all the criticism, stuff they say about Rav Gorin, I have to acknowledge that even before he comes chief rabbi, there are, we find criticisms of him from important figures. So here, I want to show you a statement here. Here's a statement from the summer of 1972. And this statement could never have appeared a few years before, when Rav Gorin was just in the army. But it says as follows. I want to make myself a note here. I want to show you something next week. It says that like a wind of I guess impropriety is sweeping the land, the state of Israel, that this approach that we can change the accepted halacha and we can permit things that are forbidden. They don't say who they're referring to, but it's obvious who it is. And it's included in this book. And they say, we declare that anyone who says this has no share in halacha. You can't rely on his rulings. And who signs this? Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, very important, Rav, the Stipler, Rabbi Shach, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, Rav Moshe Chevroni, Rav Yoshev, who's on the Beis Din, member of the Beis Din HaGadol, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So already you see here that this is not going to be like the other disputes that we know. For the Stipler and for Rav Shach to attack someone like Rav Gorin, that's to be expected. You're not going to lose sleep over that. Yes, those are Gedolei Yisrael. You have to respect them, but you can ignore their attacks because you know where they're coming from if you're in Rav Gorin's camp. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? Shlomo Zalman Auerbach never attacked anyone. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach sees Rav Gorin as a danger. His approach to halacha. Rav Elyashiv? Rav Elyashiv's not a political person, was never a political person up to then. He simply was a dayan. And yet he signs, as a dayan, he signs a document that we're going to see his involvement in opposing Rav Gorin's election to chief rabbinate next class. He signs this document. Rav Yecheskel Abramsky? What does Rav Yecheskel Abramsky have to do with politics? He doesn't. And he signs this. Furthermore, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, he's not a political person. And Rav Moshe Chevroni, Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron. Now, Rav Gorin is from Chevron. He's considered the Eli of Chevron, the great one from Chevron. So already you see that it's complicated here. Let me begin with 5 minutes. We'll start the case, and then I want to show you things I didn't get to last class. Okay, so let me begin with the story, and we're going to work. We'll start with the story, and then we got to explain. There's all sorts of aspects which we have to explain. I mean, after all, how is it Rav Gorin becomes chief rabbi? There already is a chief rabbi, and what do the politicians have to do with this? But let's start with the story in Kislev, December, I guess it was in 1973. Rav Gorin issues a psak that these Langer children—I can show you pictures of them—are not mamzerim. And on that very night, both Langer children are married. The marriages are performed by Rav Mordechai Piron, chief rabbi of the army. He took over from Rav Gorin. And the other wedding is performed by Rav Ushpizai, who was the rabbi of Ramat Gan. This ruling of Rav Gorin and the marriage, and they were careful to do the marriage immediately to make a fait accompli, came after the case had been in different courts for many years. And 12 different dayanim meeting in different courts had ruled that the Langer children were mamzerim. However, Rav Gorin came to a different ruling. So let me begin with the story. You can find the story told in a number of places. One of them is in Rabbi Bleich's article. He has an article on the Langer case, but there's many. So I'll use Rabbi Bleich. I'll use others as well. In Poland, there was a girl named Chava Ginsburg, who was 14 or 15. She met a non-Jewish boy whose name was Borakowski. They ran off and lived together, even though she was underage. She converted to Christianity and they married in the village church. Now, the story that was later told is that the young man converted, took the name Avraham, and remarried Chava in a Jewish ceremony. And they had two children. The one was born in Poland. The one born in Poland was baptized by the father, which, by the way, raises questions about, did he really convert? So The story is that he converted, they remarried, they had one child in Poland, who was baptized, and then another child in Israel. In 1933, they moved to Israel, and they later separate without getting halachically divorced. So already you see we have two possible sfeikot, doubts. Did this man ever really convert? And were they ever really married? That's going to be two of the issues. Chava would later meet and marry a Jewish man named Otto Langer. And later she would reveal that she falsely told the rabbi who married her to Otto Langer that she had never been married. And she gave her name not as Chava Barakovsky, but as Chava Ginsburg. Later, in 1951, Avram Barakovsky and Chava Langer come to the Beis Din in Tel Aviv. Barakovsky wanted to get remarried, and he needed a get to get remarried. So that would imply that he did feel Jewish, because why else would he need a get? But so when they were at the Beis Din together, it becomes known that obviously they were married, and yet Chava never told anyone that she was married when she married Langer. So that means that the marriage to Otto Langer was an adulterous marriage. Now, Chava had two children with this Otto Langer. One was named Chanoch, and the other was named Miriam. This husband, Langer, died, and Chava wants to remarry. And she comes to the Beis Din in 55. In 1951, the Beis Din doesn't realize that she has children. But in 1955, she comes to the Beis Din in Tel Aviv, and now the Beis Din learns that she wants to remarry, that she has two children. But they also know from the records that her marriage to Otto Langer was adulterous, because she never got a get from her first husband, and she has two children, Chanoch and Miriam, and they declare these children mamzerim. It's like an open and shut case. She's married to one guy, Barakovsky. She separates from him, doesn't get a get, marries a second person, has children. The two children are mamzerim. And this is recorded in a book so that all future Batei Din will know in the state of Israel that these two children are mamzerim, so they can't remarry. Now, today they don't have books. They have computers. This is a issue we have to keep in mind, because we know that in previous years, it's hard to understand halakhically how this is possible, but we know that they didn't keep records of mamzerim. So we have reports that if in one city kids are mamzerim, they'd be told to go to another city where no one knows them. But that's hard to understand, because there's still an isser on the mamzer to marry someone else. And yet we know this was done. That the idea is once the mamzer is absorbed, it's forgotten. So we know people would do that. And we even have reports that rabbis would advise doing that, but it's hard to understand. I've never seen in a sefer that a rabbi says to do this, although there are reports they did, because I don't see the mamzer is still forbidden. But we know that the people knew that if the mamzer was forgotten about, they could remarry. So we know on their own, people would just go to other places and disappear, as it were. Okay, so what's going to happen then is in the 1960s, both Chanoch and Miriam want to marry. But of course, they're mamzerim, so they can't. So that's where the story is going to get tragic, going to get interesting. That's really where we're going to pick up next class. What I want to do this class, before I get to the questions, there's still a couple things. We'll go a little late today. I'm going to save till next class. The other things I want to show you, I do just want to show you, because I'm on a different computer that you can hear things. I want to show you something. We've spoken in the past about the Pioneer Hotel. The Hotel of Leo Gartenberg that all the Gedolim used to go to, which was never under Hashkacha, that today they tell you it's forbidden. It's absolutely, I can't tell you how many people have written to me that they remember going to the Pioneer Hotel. Nikki, I think you remember too. But I told you, I worked at Simcha by the Sea, where Ramosha Feinstein's family came. I was the waiter for Reuven Feinstein's daughter, Shevbrachas. There never was a mashgiach there. And yet I know that today you're not allowed to believe that this ever happened and this, whatever. But I'm going to play you something now. Because so many people were interested. We spoke a lot about the Pioneer Hotel, but there's a lot of hotels that are like this. And I've had this for a number of weeks. I didn't get a chance last semester. What I'm going to play you now, it comes from the website of the Shul in Kew Gardens. I don't know if it's the Young Israel or Fabian Schoenfeld Shul. And he was interviewed by someone because he was very close to Rav Aaron Cutler and close to Rav Soloveitchik. So there's a whole interview here, but I'm just going to play you the part of the interview where he speaks about the Pioneer Hotel. Now, again, today, if you were at a kosher restaurant and what he describes happened, immediately no one would go to this restaurant and the hashgacha would be considered no. I mean, you can imagine. However, think about this way. And we've all had experiences, or many of us had experiences like this. You're at someone's house, a religious person, someone who's a kosher, absolutely, but they don't know all the halachas. And you see they do something that's not correct. So, you know, it depends how good friends you are with them, or if you're a rabbi, you can tell them, you know, really, this is not permitted. Or let's say they don't serve coffee to you in the proper way. Let's say they serve it in a klisheni instead of the klishlishi. So although I should know that Rav Shachman quotes Rav Soloveitchik as saying that my grandfather knew halacha, and he cooked in a klisheni. So, but okay, the Mishnah Berurah says klishlishi, so that's what we do, but there could be a heter that not to embarrass someone if it's a klisheni, whatever, ask your local rabbi. So you privately, you tell the person, you know, really you should do it this way, but it doesn't mean they're not kosher. It just means they don't know. So you're going to hear something, and Rav Aaron Cutler doesn't get up and declare it's not kosher. He tells Leo Gartenberg what the halacha is, and from now on, Leo Gartenberg is going to do it. Now, how Leo Gartenberg, for years in a catering hall, doesn't know this, and how this is the first time this comes up, I'm not really sure. But listen, kasha from a maisa, we say in yeshiva, but I just want you to hear the story. Because I think the story is, I think it's incredible. So, here, let me play it for you. And this is Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. And then I'll take the questions.
I was once in the convention of Torah Masala, the Gartenberg Geschäfte, the Pioneer Country.
Yeah.
And I was sitting, it happened at the table next to Raval.
Yeah.
Raval came to speak.
Yeah.
In those years, people went makbid on mixed seating.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Ravan came to speak at the convention. I was sitting there, and Ravan was eating in the table, mamish next to me.
Yeah.
And he calls over Leo Gartenberg. Did you know Leo Gartenberg?
Yeah, yeah.
He says to him, Mr. Gartenberg, go to the Prem of Kashrut. Said, there was no Mashkiach there.
Yeah.
Gartenberg was Gartenberg.
Right.
And he said, who's your cook?
Yeah.
So he said, my cook is Mrs. Buxbaum.
Right, I remember her.
Yeah, Mrs. Buxbaum. Uh-huh. She cooked Alza Lane, Rabban asked him. He said, no, it's not Alza, it's Alza. Is there any goyim among them? Yeah, I've got a couple of goyim cooks to help a cook. What's that from the Mishlachim?
Uh-huh.
So Gartenberg, no. He says, tell me, sag mir, wer sit on the fire dort?
Uh-huh.
So I tell you the truth, ich weiß nicht. I assume, I don't know. So Rabban says to him, Herr Zahein, which means from right now as we're eating,
yeah,
you have to give me a haftache, and I trust you that all the fires will be lit by Yisrael. By Yisrael.
Uh-huh.
Not the goyim can kochen, but the halacha requires you to,
yeah,
to light the fire, the pilot light.
Right.
I was sitting there, Rabban said this.
Mm-hmm.
Rabban introduced the whole idea of it's not an idea, the idea is the Shulchan Aruch,
yeah,
but to make sure that all these hotels, don't get so often. God, Leah Gartenberg promised him, and believe me, Leah Gartenberg promised it was done.
Right, I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
So here you have, he's telling us that in the Pioneer Hotel, that all the Gedolim ate, that there was Mishalakum, that they didn't properly light the fire. So what does Avaron do? He tells them, this is what you have to do. But he trusts the Gartenberg. Gartenberg didn't know the halacha. So now he told him, now Gartenberg knows the halacha. So that's Rabbi Schoenfeld speaking to this guy. He collected all these interviews about Rav Aaron Cutler. So if you find the story amazing, and it is amazing, but it's really no different. The hotel was like at someone's house. If you go to someone's house and you see that a non-Jew turns on the stove and cooks it, you tell them, you know, that shouldn't be done this way. You have to do it. That's how it was Hamish. And that's how, so what can I tell you? It's, that's Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld telling the story. And, so let me get to, the comments here. We've just begun. So, let's see. Ben Melech says, deciding differently in the state of Israel is also part of Yishai Leibovitz's critique. Yes, it is true. Although Yishai Leibovitz is not, he's not a posek, he's not a Gadol B'Yisrael. He set forth ideologically that we have to decide differently. And the rabbi should have to should figure out how to do it. But Rav Gorin really thought, just think about this. You're in a, it's in all areas, let's say police. From the Haredi perspective, the irreligious, they'll be the ones who are the policemen. You know, this is not for us. For us, it's Hilchos of the Mashiach, when Mashiach comes. But if you really believe that halacha can survive, can exist in the state of Israel, then you have a problem. So let's say I'm someone breaking in your house. So you call the police, a Shabbos. You're allowed to call the police. It's a matter of life and death, maybe. So the police come to your house, they arrest the guy. What are they supposed to do now? Are they supposed to stay in your house to the end of Shabbos? Can they drive back to the police station? I mean, these are the sorts of questions. You're on an army base. Can you continue working on the tanks and everything? I mean, all these questions, electricity, all these questions, you can have it. The Shulchan Aruch assumes that there's going to be a guy around on Shabbos that you can help you if you have an issue. What do you do if you're living in a place in Israel where the local Arabs, it's dangerous? You have you have no goyim. Well, these are questions. And so Rav Gorin was the first one to really deal with this. So I summarize the actual situation. Someone says, Rav Moshe, Rav Kamenetsky, Rav Hankin, this is Rabbi Kelman, said we should follow the Aruch HaShulchan, not the Mishnah Berurah, as the former was the Rav. Yes, that is true, that the Aruch HaShulchan was deciding not in a theoretical sort of sense, but as a communal rabbi. A male mamzer can't marry a male mamzer can marry a convert. A female mamzer cannot. And the children are also mamzerim, yes. Now someone asks, do we know what prompted the first Beit Din to rule that the kids were mamzerim? Okay. Well, I just told you in brief, but it's gonna, next class, we're gonna continue the story. This begins with the local Beit Din. It goes to the next level. It goes to the highest basin of the land. And then it's sent back. The highest Bate Din try to find a solution. And remember, we're not dealing with extremists here. On the final basin, you had Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef, if he cannot find a heter, I mean, he found hetering for all sorts of things. Rav Shaul Yisraeli. And we're going to have issues of procedure. If the Supreme Court of the State of Israel, the final court, based in Agodo, Irurim, of the appeals court, rules that the kids are mamzerim, do we have a concept in Judaism like Rav Gorin, where he says, well, I'm going to open up my own independent based in? And procedurally, is that even allowed? And we will see. And on what basis? What's the basis? What's the halachic arguments? Why did the Bate Din declare the kids mamzerim? And what did Rav Gorin find? New information that enables him to free the children. So that's probably, we'll look at next class. And then the dispute. Then the heavens open, the earth opens. The stuff you're going to hear, you might have to do Kriya, some of the stuff you hear, the controversy that breaks out. And who supports Rav Gorin? We can thank Yair Levy and a couple others. The nine Dayanim, the secret Dayanim, Rav Gorin will open a secret Beis Din in which no one knows the names, but by now we know the names. And So we're just beginning. There's a lot to do. I'm sorry. Maybe I went out of order. I was setting the stage of the whole anger issue. I thought most people knew the basic case. But we ended up coming back to the beginning. So now you know the basic case. As I said, it just seems like a simple case. It's a case that Bati didn't deal with this all the time. A case of Mamzerus, you find them, the kids that they can't marry, they can marry, whatever, you have disputes. It's not the end of the world. If a Basin is more lenient than you are, it happens. It happens every week, the cases like this. So that's what makes this case so unusual. MJ Frankel says that he was a busboy, but he never got promoted to full waiter. Okay, I don't know, Michael, maybe you challenged Leo Gartenberg's kashrus. I don't know why he didn't promote you, but
I have to find another career path.
Another career path. Okay. That's it then. No, so like I said, we just started, and Rabbi Kelman.
More marriages came from Gartenberg and Schechter.
Yeah. And they had another hotel too. It wasn't just the pioneer, but it is amazing that like a good Yisrael would have their conventions there, because in the summer they had swimming, mixed swimming. They had dancing. I mean, they had performers, women singers, and yet that was the era. It was still a Hamish place. Yeah.
When did it close? And this is before my time, you know, the Pioneer, all these hotels. It's, you know, and I live in Canada, so what do I know? But I'm just curious. When did this all stop?
I don't anybody? Know. 60s? No, we were 70s and would have been open still, because Rabbi Tendler's daughter got married there to Rabbi Rappaport, who was in the 70s. So sometime it would have been in the 70s, I guess mid-70s. Grossinger's already, Grossinger's had Ashkacha, the Concord, but those were not religious people running it. So, but they used to go to the rabbis used to go to the Grossinger's also. The Concord was, Kashrus and the Concord was always iffy, but Grossinger's and the people went, and the Pine View, and you know, a bunch of these places, the Browns, the Homowack, these were the places we used to go. Yeah,
I came to New York. They had the Homowack, but that was under the OU. That was already under the Leshkach with the OU.
Yeah, but the Grossinger's was under Rabbi Chevelle for a while. There are different ones, but I remember
I remember. One year, Max Stern made a big fuss. He sent out a letter to his whole community, but because he had a disagreement with Grossinger's, he was not going there for Pesach. And it was that pressure, I think, that led to either hiring or rehiring Rabbi Chevelle to be the Rav HaMashgiach of Grossinger's.
Who was the Rav when he went for him? I don't know. But they had a hush. I always think, I believe they always had a Mashgiach, Grossinger's. Maybe I'm wrong, but they were not religious people.
I don't know anyone Orthodox who went to Grossinger's.
Until Rabbi Chevelle came, there was no independent Mashgiach. Maybe it was someone that was hired by the family, and people said, well, he can't stand up to the family because he'll lose his job. But it was when Rabbi Chevelle was installed that he was clearly had an independent reputation, and if he found something was wrong, he would be happy to say so.
Okay. But you know, historically, Mashgichim are always hired by the person. Until we have our VOD system, they always would be hired independently. That's how they did it. But I remember, I don't know, Lawrence, if you have the same, when I was young, we never went to the Concord, and I remember the Concord, Kashrus was always regarded as not at the same level, or Kutcher's was not at the same level as Grossinger's.
Kutcher's wasn't kosher.
Well, it was under Hashkafa. I know that. And we went there once. I went with my
nobody
cousins.
I know would have gone to Kutcher's. Yeah. We went to the Lake House.
Yeah, the Lake House. But it had Hashkafa by Safra. But even the Concord, I remember the reputation was not so good.
Right.
These are the glory days of the Catskills, right? This is like
New York, we don't need it. We have air
before people have the money to travel here and there. You know, today Torah in Motion goes to France and to Italy and to Spain. Yeah. You know, people, it was a lot different back then.
That's what killed the hotels. That's what ended the hotels when they were, flights were going to everywhere. And it was relatively inexpensive.
They were awful.
What I
I thought they were awful.
And also, but also, Nikki, the younger generation didn't feel like they need to vacation with Jews. You know, they go to Club Med, you know.
Exactly.
And air conditioning, you don't need, you know, it's not like you go up in the summer, you know. And so I think a lot of things.
I presume you remember the debate. I remember, I must have been in high school. Yeah. I don't know. The debate in Tradition. I forget who it was. One of the rabbis in Tradition magazine from the RCA, you know, the Modern Orthodox, wrote about going on a Club Med vacation and what they wrote.
He wasn't a rabbi. It was David Singer.
Oh, there you go. And the next
one. I believe he responded to, was it you, Larry? Responding to you? I know, Lawrence Grossman. Sorry, he was responding to. Yes, he wrote about Club Med.
And then somebody criticized him very heavily. Yeah. How can Orthodox Jews go to Club Med and the whole.
Yeah, but it's, but I'm talking about Grossinger's is full of non-Orthodox people. You'd go there, it would be, but non-Orthodox Jews still like to be in a Jewish environment with the Jewish comedians and all that sort of stuff. Simon Says, what's his name, was there? what's his name on Simon Says? Lou Goldstein, right?
Lou Goldstein, right.
Lou Goldstein. So, I mean, it was a Hamish environment.
My father was there before Pesach Grossinger's, and he said he was so impressed. The mashgiach stood at the front door of the dining room, and all the waiters lined up in front of them. They had to give in their silverware and their stuff, and they then got the Pesach ticket stuff. I mean, he said it was an unbelievable scene. So apparently, it was quite well done.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Very nice.
Put down memory lane. But okay, this is just, like I said, I always say it's like the song. We've only just begun. Next week, we'll get into the meat of this whole issue here and be rabbi. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, have all our regular classes this week. Next week, by the way, we're going to have two new classes that are beginning. Tamar Weitzman's going to go, you know, it's Rosh Chodesh Shvat, which means Rosh Chodesh Adar is not too far away. So we're going to start on Megillat Esther. And then, that's Monday. And Tuesday, Rabbi Adam Mintz is going to be giving a 5-part series, I think fascinating on, related, I guess, a little bit, but coincidentally, on the history of conversion in America. You know, I think everybody here knows that the conversion standards were different in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s into the 80s and whatever. So Rabbi Mintz will be giving a 5-part series. That's going to be starting a week Tuesday. So next Monday, next Tuesday, and all our regular classes are continuing. So look forward to learning with you. So I would say your admission is to invite one person to come to a class who hasn't come before. That's what he asks you to do, and that's word of mouth is our best form of advertising. So please invite your friends to come to. We have many different classes on many different you know subject. They gotta like something. Anyways, okay. Thank you, everybody. Laila Tov. And all good thing. And thank you, the Sasson family, for your sponsorship. And okay, we look forward to learning with you in the near future. Laila Tov, everybody.